Hey, and welcome back for another CaperCast. This is number 42, another gab about early modern seafaring literature. Last time we spoke, I mentioned Sterling Hayden, but I forgot to tell you that with his ship, the Wanderer, he managed to steal his own children and sail away to the Marquesas. Yes, right after our son Stephen had his first birthday party aboard the Wanderer, Hayden and his recently divorced wife were going through a big hassle over possession of the children. And his lawyer told him that possession was 90% of the law, and so he just took them, climbed aboard the boat, and sailed away for a long sea voyage in the Pacific. I don't think he got away with it in the end. The last time I saw him was at the Magic Mountain Music Festival, a great blowout rock concert that was held in a natural cirque, a bowl, up on Mount Tamalpais, north of San Francisco. He was in disguise, hoping to not be recognized by the public, and I don't know, he probably had lawyers chasing him around. Of course, we started by mentioning Joshua Slocum, the first single-hander circumnavigator. There have been many others subsequently. And we mustn't forget John Guswell in his little ship Trekka. He was the first Britisher to sail single-handed around the world. And the title of his book was Trekka, the name of the boat, T-R-E-K-K-A, a definite read. But Guswell himself was also featured in another book about another voyage. While on his trip, he happened to meet up with Miles and Beryl Smeaton. They were preparing to cross the South Atlantic, and they needed crew, so Guswell decided to go with them, which turned out to be a very good thing for the Smeatons, because on their passage they were pitchpoled, and for the second time. A pitchpole is that crack-up that is actually a somersault, where in the case of monohulls, such as in which they were all traveling, usually a wave overtakes the vessel from astern and picks it up so as to purl or dive the bow, and the boat literally somersaults stern over bow. I've always thought that that was caused primarily by resistance, that is, a single-hull vessel, particularly a heavily loaded and classic rather wide cruising boat, simply cannot go very fast, and the crest of the wave is trying to make the vessel go as fast as the wave is going. And in order to do that, the boat has to surf, which a wide, heavy monohull cannot do. So it's the resistance on the hull of the vessel combined with the crest overtaking from astern that literally somersaults the vessel. Whereas a pitchpole in multi-hulls is not quite the same. It's usually caused by just extreme pressure in the sails, wind pressure, and very high speed, causing the boat to dive the lee bow, one that is not sufficiently buoyant to resist such pressure. It usually happens while power reaching at extremely high speeds, and once the leeward bow is submerged, it can catch or trip over its own foredeck and capsize diagonally, that is, the upwind stern over the downwind bow. Well, anyway, the Smeatons, with Guswell aboard, were capsized in the South Atlantic, and there was damage. The boat came up without its rig, and damage to the superstructure. Typically, damage is to the after cabin bulkhead, the wave crest that causes the pitchpole comes charging through the cockpit and slams into the hatchway bulkhead and crashes it in. I think that's what happened in the case of the Smeaton's vessel. But it did recover right side up. It had taken on a lot of water, and Beryl was lost overboard. Well, somehow, miraculously, she managed to get back on board, and Guswell turned immediately to repairing the damage. He was a highly skilled boat builder, had been through an apprenticeship as a young man after being a prisoner of war during World War II, as a young man with his family in a German concentration camp. Guswell took a formal British apprenticeship to a boat builder, had built his own boat, Trekka, and those skills now became critical because Guswell was able to repair the damage quickly enough to keep another wave from boarding the boat and very likely taking her down. Now, this was the second time that the Smeatons had been pitchpoled in the same yacht. And so Smeaton's book about the incident is entitled Once is Enough, Miles Smeaton. Recommended read. Well, they were able to complete that crossing under jury rig, and Guswell later returned to his own little boat and completed his circumnavigation. I knew Guswell, and I had the opportunity to write a in-depth profile of the man for Wooden Boat Magazine. It's in there someplace in the literature if anyone's interested. I think you can find it online. The title of the article is Able to Go, which comes from his answer to a question I asked him at the end of our interview. He was speaking of having made a circumnavigation of New Zealand, which of course takes one way down into the Southern Ocean. And I asked him if he was planning to go a-voyaging again. And he said, oh, we'll no doubt make the odd cruise. But you know, Jim, it's not so much the idea of going, it's being able to go. And that really stayed with me because, of course, it's not just a matter of having the experience and skills and the boat in order to go cruising. It's getting your life in order, getting your affairs arranged so that you can take off. That seems to be the hard part. Just getting the hell out of the harbor. From my experience, the rest of it is relatively easy. It just happens. Well, I promised to tell you about Eric and Susan Hiscock, H-I-S-C-O-C-K. Please notice that women are very much a part of some of this literature. Electra Johnson, Irving called her Lexi, and she did much of the writing about their voyaging in the great brigantine Yankee, and a subsequent much smaller vessel that they designed and built for cruising just between the two of them. And Beryl Smeaton, oh my God, she traveled all over the world, adventure traveled as a single woman in an age when that just wasn't done, and sort of ended up marrying Miles as an afterthought and ended up being pitchpoled in the South Atlantic and washed overboard. There's a wonderful book about her, I'm afraid I don't remember its title. But wow, what a woman. She went down from breast cancer, refused to have it operated on. And here comes Eric and Susan Hiscock, a great navigating pair. They had four vessels, all named Wanderer, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And they made at least two circumnavigations, I'm thinking, plus lots of other cruising. And Eric was a gifted how-to writer. He published two big books, Cruising Under Sail and Voyaging Under Sail, both of them definitive volumes on how it is done. He covered everything, including the design and construction of their boats, why they were designed and constructed so, all the rigging details of the day, planning, provisioning, food storage, preparation, and navigation. I mean, piloting and seamanship and celestial navigation. He had a great knack of telling one how to find his way in the ocean before GPS. And not only did he write from on board, he also arranged to process his own black and white photographs on board. So his books are just loaded with detailed photos. Wonderful resource. The Hiscocks told their story with typical British reserve, but boy, it painted a bright stripe. And there's no doubt in my mind that their work is the actual bedrock of our modern post-war cruising lifestyle. And I would like to spend the rest of this little podcast explaining how we once had the opportunity to thank them for it. As with many of my personal yarns in this Capercast business, I often feel like I must have told you this story before. But I've looked through these audio files and don't find it, so if I'm repeating myself, well, I'm repeating myself. It's a good story. Yes, it's a Mark Hassel story. It happened in about 1971. Joanna and I were nearing the end of a 10-year struggle to get our cruising boat ready to go and get our affairs in order so that we could take off as a family. And Mark Hassel, human dynamo that he was, of course, had beat us to it. I've told you of how he built one boat and lost it in a shipwreck. And now he'd built another and he was ready to take off around the world with his new wife, Bonnie, and his 10-year-old son, David. Hey, there's another one. Bonnie Hassel. Talk about a main brace. She was fundamental to this voyage. So they were getting close to leaving, but Mark felt that he needed to do a serious shakedown of the vessel before taking off across the Pacific. He asked me where I thought he should go for such a shakedown. Well, it was March, and I told him that I thought if he could sail his boat from Los Angeles to San Francisco up the California coast at that time of year, that he could probably sail it anywhere. And I mean, this is an iron coast, folks. Boy, that northwest wind comes howling down along it, often blowing in the upper teens to the upper 20s, day and night. Dark skies, lots of rain, and cold. Only good for going south. So they started from Ventura, I think in their 37-foot Sea Runner trimaran, and after two tries managed to get around Point Conception going north. Point Conception, locally known as the Cape Horn of the Pacific, the fishermen say, it'll make a Christian of you. And on their first try, Mark said that they were going against such seas that the boat was literally standing on its transom at times. Well, that's probably slightly exaggerated, but you can imagine. So they turned back once, but on their second try, they hit a patch of fair weather and managed to get up the coast as far as Morro Bay, my favorite California harbor. But Mark called from there and he said, hey, Jim, we need help. We're going to do this, but we can't do it alone. So I, of course, called Joe Hudson, and the two of us met the boat there in Morro Bay. And I was really biting my lip, man. The last thing I wanted to do was make this trip. But we took off in blowy weather, and the boat was doing fine. We got up there into the lee of San Simeon. It's a minor promontory on this coast, the location, incidentally, of the Hearst Castle. But it's a wide-open roadstead with just the barest of shelter. And we approached in late afternoon and felt some protection from the wind, but the open Pacific was rolling in there in 10-foot swells. We were really reluctant to try to anchor for an overnight rest, but I'll be darned, now and then we could see that there was another yacht in the anchorage. We could only really see it when both vessels were on a crest. Otherwise, we could just see the tops of its ketch rig. And one thing for sure, it was really rolling. But the bottom there is described as good hard sand, the best anchor holding you can get. So we approached the other boat within about an eighth of a mile, dropped a Danforth, and yanked on it good and hard. It felt like we were really hooked in, and we were. And as we got our sails secured for the night, Joe Hudson asked Bonnie for the binoculars. He perched himself on deck, spied it for a while, and said, I just read an article about that boat. That's Eric and Susan Hiscock's new boat. Wanderer 4. I can see the name on her. Wanderer 4. That's the Hiscock's. Well, Joe and I bumped heads getting the dinghy in the water. Boarding it was a gymnastic feat. 10-year-old David insisted on going with us. And as we rowed across the water, there were times when we could not see the hull of either vessel. We actually felt very much alone and at risk in the dinghy. And about halfway across, we could see that the Wanderer 4 was rolling her rails down. But looking back at our boat, she was bobbing like a duck. It was the best evidence I've ever seen of a comparison between the two types of vessels in a rolly anchorage. So we didn't go too close to Wanderer, didn't want to intrude, just wanted to have a good close look at her. We rowed around. There was no one on deck, of course. And about the time we thought of heading back, out popped both of these people, Eric and Susan Hiscock, waving at us, come aboard! My God, that was a thrill. And so was getting aboard. Jumping from an 8-foot dinghy to a 42-foot catch in such conditions was, I mean, it was luck that we made it. David made it look easy. And the next thing we knew, we were down in the cabin with these people, making introductions, followed by rum and stew with Eric and Susan Hiscock. Boy, what a peak experience. And it turned out that they, too, were headed for San Francisco. And we spoke of the coming voyage up the Big Sur coast, 50 miles with no harbors. Nothing but mountains falling into the sea. Joe explained that he had lived on that coast all his life, and he knew of a few coves where there might be some protection. We were hoping to try them out, and he offered to identify them on the chart for the Hiscock's. And they said, nothing doing. We're going to stay right here until it blows down, and then put to sea and stay there until we get to San Francisco. Well, it was getting late, and before we left their vessel, Joe managed to acknowledge quite eloquently, I felt, that the reason many of us cruising sailors who are out there doing it these days were there because their books had given us the confidence. They were especially pleased to have David in our midst, and it was altogether a wonderful exchange. Now, we knew that in these conditions there was no way we were going to be able to beat as far as Monterey the next day, but when we left San Simeon that morning we had high hopes of finding some protection behind Pfeiffer Point that night. But after pounding the boat, abusing the boat all the next day to windward, it was not to be. We approached Partington, looked in there, we could see nothing but breakers, teeth sticking up from the surf all along. So we headed off into the night for what was to become perhaps the most intense experience I've had in one of my boats. You know, when the sun goes down at sea, sometimes the boogeyman comes out, and in this case, so did the wind and seas. We had Mark's mainsail reefed down to the point where there was nothing but the sail number showing, and a storm staysail flying on the forestay, but both sails pulling so hard that we couldn't get another inch even with the winches. The rig was howling, both underwings were pounding, and at one point I was thrown back against the after cockpit bulkhead so as to look out astern, and in the stern light I could see that we were actually making sternway at the crest of the waves. So Mark started up the engine, and we began to chip away at it. And I'll be darned, it got worse. About the time we were off the beacon at Point Sur, we had a thunder squall with lightning and hail, a very rare occurrence in these waters. Old Poseidon was really putting Mark to the test. Mark and Joe and I had to shout to each other in order to be heard in the cockpit. Bonnie passed me up a cup of tea through a crack in the hatch, and before I could drink it, the wind siphoned it right out of the cup. And I began to fear for the boat. I knew how it was built, how it was designed. It wasn't intended to go to windward and stuff like this. I began to plead with Mark, "Hey, we gotta turn around or heave to." But neither Mark nor Joe were buying it. I mean, we've come this far. But in one particularly heavy gust, I reached down and slacked the staysail sheet by, I don't know, maybe a couple of inches, just to take a little of the load off of the poor boat. And Mark went off like a firecracker. He hollered at me, "You told me if we could sail this boat up this coast at this time of year that I could sail it anywhere, and I'm going to sail it anywhere. Don't touch my sails." Holy shit, that was a thorough put down. Coming from a dear friend, I realized he was a bit manic. I mean, talk about determination. So I quietly slithered below and crawled into a bunk, and discovered that that was no respite. Just lying there listening to the boat going through its agony, that single-cylinder diesel just pounding away, and the waves just slamming on the underwings, spray just shotgunning the cabin sides. All I could think about was that 3/8-inch plywood and those little glue strips and weldwood glue, you know. I fully expected the boat to just implode. I was scared. I was scared sick. But Mark and Joe managed to take the boat through till the false dawn, when I came up and found that things had calmed down a bit. Mark and Bonnie had decided it was time to get off of the world. We hove to, bounded around for a while, but had breakfast. I composed myself. They all retired, and I managed to sail the boat up around Point Pinos and into Monterey. And I thought of Minnie Pearl in the Grand Old Opry, who used to come on stage and say, "I'm just as glad to be here." Well, that's enough blab for now. I hope you'll take me up on some of the reading recommendations. And the next time we get together, I hope to have a report for you on the start and maybe the finish of the R2AK. Okay, I guess what all this says to a budding boat designer, or to a seasoned salt sailor, is that you'll never know what you really got there in a boat until you get cold, tired, hungry, wet, seasick, and scared. Bye-bye.